Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
When I was about 6 or 7, my mother and father sat me down and told me that I was adopted. But then after that, I became extremely self-destructive, because I thought that I had killed my mother, you see. I was only a child at this time, so I didn't have much understanding. I had perception that I was born and my mother died. Therefore, I caused my mother's death, you understand? Meanwhile, all from childhood, you know, and part of my adult years, I walked around with this death wish, because I felt I now had to pay for her death, you see. And that somewhere I thought that there was a man out there that hated me and was possibly going to try to kill me for causing the death of his wife.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 2, The Adoption. Act 1, A Normal Jewish Home. On June 4th, 1953, Pearl and Nathan Berkowitz left their modest one-bedroom apartment at 1105 Stratford Avenue in the Bronx and drove south to Brooklyn. After nearly 11 years of marriage, they were about to become parents for the first time. Nat and Pearl were an incredibly happy couple, and always had been, falling hopelessly in love with each other shortly after meeting. Pearl was a promising young lady with no shortage of admirers, but in Nat, she saw something special, and the two were soon wed. It was 1941, and war loomed on the horizon as the U.S. was about to enter World War II.
This is John Daly speaking from the CBS newsroom in New York. Here is the Far East situation as reported to this moment. The Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the Philippines.
But rather than wait and see what fortunes, or indeed misfortunes, the war might bring, the two young lovers decided not to take any chances and got married early the following year, just as war for the United States had become a reality. In fact, they entered the war effort together, both serving at a base down south, Pearl in the Women's Army Corps, and Nat serving as a master sergeant. When the war was over, they returned to New York, opened a small neighborhood hardware store on Melrose Avenue in the Bronx, and set about starting a family of their own. Pearl was a loving and nurturing soul and wanted desperately to be a mother. But try as they may, something wasn't working and their efforts were unsuccessful. Soon, they would find out why. Pearl had cancer. So instead of starting a family, Nat and Pearl Berkowitz started a years-long struggle for Pearl's life instead. And 4 years later, in 1949, after a mastectomy proved successful, the battle appeared to be over and Pearl's cancer seemed to be in remission. Despite emerging victorious, the battle against the murderous disease had left the pair more than just a little gun-shy, not to mention exhausted. And so they decided to wait and make sure Pearl was in the clear before they went through with their plans to adopt a child. So it seemed like fate, 4 years later, in the spring of 1953, when Pearl received a call from her cousin. There was a young woman she knew in Brooklyn by the name of Betty Falco, who was pregnant and unable to keep the child. Still, being cautious and careful people, Nat and Pearl had to think it over, and I'm sure they were more than just a little bit nervous. It had been so long, and they had fought so hard, and after all, it was possible the cancer could come back. But on the other hand, it had been 4 years, and there was still no sign of the cancer returning. They weren't getting any younger, and at some point, they must have thought, you just have to live your life. So they put aside their hesitation, picked up the phone, dialed Pearl's cousin, and told her to inform Betty and the hospital that they would take the child on as their own. It was finally happening. Nat and Pearl were going to be parents. So, on June 4th, 1953, just 3 days after David Berkowitz had been born Richard David Falco in the borough of Brooklyn, Nat and Pearl bundled him up and took him home to their apartment in the Soundview neighborhood of the South Bronx. Standing alone in their apartment, a by all counts happy and healthy baby boy in their arms, the pair were ecstatic. It was everything they ever wanted. Nat was 43 and Pearl 37. Here's our co-host, veteran prison reporter, Jack Jones.
David, I think to Pearl, was a gift from God. As a cancer survivor and as someone who could no longer even consider the possibility of having her own child, finally having a child meant to Pearl that she had another opportunity to continue living. She was grateful and she wanted to do all the right things to raise a good human being. And she tried to put him on a pedestal where he certainly proved that he did not belong.
The relationship was complicated from the beginning.
Mother was always around. In fact, she paid too much attention to me. She spoiled me with regards to attention. My father, he wasn't around that much.
His father was a caring person, but like a lot of men who was struggling to make a living and run his own business during an economically tough time, was a caring but distant father figure. Didn't quite know how to relate to this child that had suddenly come into his life.
Nat loved his son, but the hardware store was a struggle, and he found himself working long hours away from home in order to provide the bare necessities for his wife and child. Necessities that would never prove enough for a young David Berkowitz.
I remember my first allowance. I asked my dad, can I have an allowance? You know, because my friends downstairs, Jeffrey and Irwin, just two guys I grew up with, are getting an allowance. And they were only getting 15 cents. So I went to my dad, can I have allowance? Irwin and Jeffrey get 15 cents each every week for spending. And my dad gave me $1. And I used to walk around with a $1 bill and hold it up. And the kids just couldn't believe it, were in shock. You know, a $1 bill, look, he's got a $1 bill. I was only 5 or 6 years old. And a $1 bill in those days could buy, you know, how much candy? A whole mountain of candy. Because candy bars were a nickel. Milky Way bars, Three Musketeer bars were a nickel. Baseball cards, a pack of them were a nickel. You buy 20 packs of baseball cards, a whole box. And I had all that. So I was spoiled rotten.
While Nat was busy trying to make a living, Pearl was endlessly available to her son and endeavored tirelessly to shower him with the love and attention she had waited so long to express. David would later say, quote, my mother purchased all kinds of candies, fruits, nuts, and cakes, left them around the living room and in the kitchen, so I had an opportunity to nosh on all sorts of goodies, end quote. And nosh on them he did. David Berkowitz was a chubby child with an angelic face and an innocent smile. Looks that got him almost anything he asked for. Pearl was a soft touch. One thing was for certain, though. The connection between David and Pearl was an intense one, and it's hard to tell who cared for whom more deeply. Pearl loved David, and he loved her right back. She was his world, and he clung to her tightly. He didn't want to spend any time away from her. David was a mama's boy. Quote, when I did start school, I used to fight with my mom when she tried to take me. I hated to leave her because I didn't want to miss anything. Pearl had to take me to school and make sure I went in, end quote. While his love for Pearl was nearly all-consuming, He seemed to have little to no use for his father, Nat, and often saw him as a threat.
There was a feud between me and my father in my childhood years, because when he did come home, he took my mother away from me, you know what I mean? So I was the only child. And so my mother could spoil me, and I liked that, you know, getting attention. But when he was home, she had to give a lot of attention to him. So, like, he got in the way.
Despite an active, albeit one-sided, game of tug-of-war for love and attention feverishly pursued by David within the Berkowitz home, the Berkowitz themselves were just an average Jewish family living in the South Bronx.
Did your parents take you to synagogue?
Yeah. Grew up in a regular Jewish home. They were Reformed Jews, though. They weren't religious. But still, I went through all the rituals, you know, going to the synagogue on high holy days.
They were traditional Jewish couple, not Orthodox by any means. They were more modern and, he says, not really religious people, but they did observe the high holy days and went to synagogue. And he was raised as a traditional sort of modern Jewish kid.
Years later, David would comment to his psychiatrist about Pearl's observation of Jewish customs. Quote, "She lit these Sabbath candles faithfully every Friday evening and whenever a sacred Jewish holiday came about. I remember how she put a towel over her head, then opened up a tattered prayer book and quietly recited some verses. She did this as she was lighting the three candles and immediately after she finished. Obviously, my mother was very religious as far as observing rituals. She also kept a kosher house, and we had separate silverware for dairy and for meat. We ate baked potatoes, often with meat. Me, I always liked butter on my baked potatoes, so when I tried to sneak some butter onto them, my mother screamed her head off, 'No butter with the meat, David!' As for my father, he never went for this candle lighting stuff. He is somewhat of an agnostic, and like me, sees no value in religious ceremonies." End quote. But while Pearl endeavored to observe the customs of her faith, she wasn't overly spiritual.
My parents never believed in any devils or demons. It was mainly just a belief that God and his angels were watching, but that they also had the ability to punish, too. Punish more than reward you for doing good deeds.
The concept of punishment proved to be a confusing one for a young David Berkowitz, and Pearl's tender method of dealing with her son, an unlikely accelerant.
His adoptive mother was someone who cared a great deal, but was a little, maybe a lot too permissive in her rearing of this child. I think she's, you know, must have been an extremely loving and caring and forgiving person. And I think quite intelligent, trying to do her best in the, at that time, Dr. Spock way of raising children. And, you know, that's to let the child unfold like a little flower and not to try to bend or twist them with religion or these harsh punishment codes or anything else.
Pearl was a softie, and I get that. Punishing David wasn't what she wanted to do. It wasn't in her nature, and as near as I can tell, it wasn't her idea of where the arduous journey of finally succeeding in having a child in the first place had led her. She loved David. He was her everything. She wanted to shower him with that love, not take him to the woodshed. Still, when it was necessary, Nat and Pearl disciplined their child the best they could.
Were you physically punished by your parents?
Well, my father was very lenient. Well, it would reverse itself. Sometimes my father would be strict, sometimes my mother would be lenient. But they never harmed me physically, you understand, except for spanking, but I deserved it. When they spanked me, I had deserved it, you see. And they were not brutal or anything. My father was really decent. My mother and father, adopted parents who I grew up with, were decent, fair, kind, loving, everything positive. I can't find really anything about them that would lay any false to this, you know.
David knew his parents loved him. Still, there was something going on inside him from a very early age. A flicker, silent and small, that would one day fan into an all-consuming flame. An inquisitiveness born of an innate internal logic that would deliver him to some very strange places, even as a boy.
My mother used to tell me, you know, she used to tuck me in at night, every night, you know, kiss my forehead when I was a child. And she used to say, God be with you, angels be with you, pleasant dreams. She used to say it every night, you know. She'd go, good night, you know, and I'd put up a fuss. I never wanted to go to bed, you know. I was like to stay up all night, you know how kids are. And then she'd take me into the room, you know. God be with you, angels be with you, pleasant dreams. It was like a daily prayer every night, night after night, you know. I used to say, Mom, is God willing to be with me? And, yep. And the angels in here? Yep. They're all around the room watching you, you know. Angels, your guardian angels. She wasn't religious or, you know, a fanatic or anything, but she believed in that. But being that I was a kid, very impressionable, you know, and suggestible, with a wild imagination, I've always been given, like, you know, a wild imagination, that was enough. You know what I'm saying? It was always, I always had a fear that even if I did something wrong, and like my parents didn't see me, still the angels were reporting to God what I was doing. You know, and trouble would happen. The next thing you know, the next day I'd stub my toe or you know, slip in a towel or something and get all banged up. It's just like, well, I knew it, you know. Punishment is inevitable. It's got to come.
And so, what was meant to be a reassuring nightly blessing morphed into a terrifying warning as David translated, angels be with you, into the angels are watching. In other words, God's angels are watching everything you do, listening to everything you say, and hearing everything you think. And they aren't just observing, they're actively reporting it all back to God. There is no way to escape it. You have a punishment coming. And in the end, you will be punished. Punished for who you are and for doing something that you have already done.
From a very early age, he felt that he was being punished by something, kind of reasoning that it was God punishing him for this bad thing he knew he had inside himself. I mean, he had an instinct that there was something really negative inside himself. He describes himself being clumsy, falling, always scraping himself, always being driven to do something. He was a very self-destructive child.
Call it nature or call it nurture, David Berkowitz was a nervous and clumsy child who started to view his frequent missteps as direct punishment from God.
I always thought God was punishing me. My mother used to tell me, I used to bite my tongue a lot and stub my toe a lot. I was very accident-prone. Very accident-prone when I was a child, right? I don't think there was a day that went by that I didn't have a bandage on me for something or other.
Jack asks David if Pearl ever told him that God was punishing him.
Every time I bit my tongue, I used to have a habit of biting my tongue, and it was a blister, you know, it would hurt. And I used to stub my toe. I used to walk barefoot in the at the beach all the time, and there was a pool, you know, a local pool, constantly stubbing my toes until they were raw, you know. And this is God trying to trip you. She used to tell me over and over again, because it's that Pinocchio follow-up, you know what I'm saying? You know how Pinocchio, your nose will get bigger every time you lie. So every time something bad happens to you, see, this is God punishing you, you know?
Every slip and fall, every stubbed toe or bitten lip was a punishment sent from the Almighty on the advice of his angels to repay David for even the most minor infraction.
He was mystified by the concept of God and somehow seemed to reason that he was something that God reviled. And he had a very clear fantasy of God as this force that ultimately controlled his life, and that regardless of knowing what he should do to please God, he was driven to do the opposite.
David Berkowitz, even at this very early age, had determined that he was on a collision course with the cosmic forces of the universe, specifically with God himself.
And this was a sense of justice I had in the world. Cause and effect, crime and punishment, followed me all through my life, from childhood. Every time I fell, well, that made up for all the wrongs I did for that week, for that day. Every time I spurt myself or cut myself on my toys, which I was forever doing, you know. This is the same thing. Here's God punishing me, you know. I developed a strong, unconscious hatred and fear of God, you know. This hate-fear thing, you know. Because I was always afraid that he's constantly, you know, ready to punish. I had to, like, keep in line. The Supreme Being was constantly watching me, you know. I developed a tremendous fear of God punishing.
David harbored inside himself an inner sense of an infinite guilt that he in turn accepted as something he had to find expression for. Expression he felt would bring about the punishment he was endlessly deserving of. And so, punishment itself became something he was masochistically attached to, and eventually it became the end goal in and of itself. In other words, he developed a taste for it.
I think he had, and what's a psychological term, approach avoidance about being punished. He seemed to, without question, commit acts of malice instinctive in him somehow. And I think he was more than a little bit masochistic in his thoughts of being punished as, this is what I deserve because this is the kind of person I am.
Punishment completed the circle and validated the way he felt about himself. Something bad happened to me because I am bad. Of course it did. It's justified. I already knew that. Guilt and punishment, two parts of a circle David was hopelessly trapped at the center of. And Nat and Pearl trapped there with him. Pearl by design and Nat by circumstance. And so, those closest to him became the object of his resentment just as he was to himself.
Some of the resentment came from knowing that somehow he was, even though their child, very different from them, and insisting on asserting his own identity through whatever negative behaviors he could engage in to get their attention and then be punished. And that was some kind of momentary salvation for him.
All this going on silently and secretly inside her son, David to Pearl, was a gift from God. And Nat and Pearl both loved him very much, and they documented every occasion best they could. In the pictures, it's obvious to see that the pudgy, meticulously dressed David was loved and cared for. Always freshly washed, his clothes nice and neat. He was Pearl's pride and joy, and nothing would change that. Not for Pearl.
On the surface, the dynamics were two very normal, intelligent Jewish people with no reported bad habits or weirdnesses or perversions at all. And this child that they dressed up and tried to make as civilized as they possibly could. But there was something inside him that they could never reach.
Act 2. Death enters the picture. With an increasingly complex world developing inside him, there was, of course, a whole world still going on around him. And in 1958, when David was just 5 years old, an event would take place that would change the course of his young life.
I don't know what the relationship between Pearl and her parents were, but she obviously was very close to her father, and his death, according to the way David describes it, threw her into some borderline psychosis, weeping and wailing and unable to break out of a dark depression.
I saw, when I was 5 years old, my grandfather, who I was very close to, died. This was my adoptive mother's father. We lived in an apartment in Kelly Street in the Bronx. My mother got a call one day. I remember this whole thing distinctly. They got a phone call in the morning that my grandfather, Harry, who was sick. So they ran over to the Kelly Street apartment. It was like a 20-minute ride through the streets of the Bronx, right? To where they lived, where my grandparents lived, right?
Shortly after they arrived, Pearl's father passed away, and there was very little that could prepare David for his mother's reaction. Shaken to the core, Pearl fell to the floor crying, consumed with grief. She just completely lost it.
She was so grief-stricken, she was wailing, and I'd never seen anything. I was terrified, because she was on the floor in convulsions, you know what I mean? Screaming at the top of her lungs. The whole neighborhood was there, right? The police car was in front of the house, the ambulance was there, the detective's car was there, you know? He died of natural causes, you understand, but he died so just in his sleep so suddenly, you see, that my mother was close to him, that she, I have never seen a person act this way before, so grief-stricken. I didn't even recognize it was my mother, you know? They had to pin her down, you know, to hold her, and she was wailing. This went on for hours. And I was like in shock. I was in the apartment, you know. They didn't know what to do with me. They just left me on the side because my father was all upset, trying to calm her down, you know, because her father had died. And I was like terrified, you know.
David, like a sponge to the universe, soaked up his mother's grief. To say it had a huge effect on him would be an understatement.
The way that Pearl reacted to her father's death gave him a sense of not just the fear, but a sense of awe that death was somehow something special. It really generated a lot of attention.
Death was a very big deal, and as David Berkowitz began to realize, it was never that far away. Death is around us all the time, lurking just beyond our reach, waiting ever so patiently to reach out and pull one of us down. And when it happens, everyone stops. Everyone stares, everyone listens, because they know one day it'll be coming for them, too. In short, death gets people's attention. If David Berkowitz never knew that before, he most certainly knew it now. Death is the big show. So with this realization dawning to a 5-year-old David Berkowitz, he packs it away in the recesses of his mind. The first of what would be many in his bizarre box of gruesome realizations waiting to be pulled out and used at a later date.
He was a bad kid anyway, he knew it, and when he saw the impact that death had on people he admired, it became an obsession that he obviously never got over.
I became terrified of death, you see, because they wouldn't let me see him in the room. You know, I used to walk to his room all the time. I was close to him, I used to sit on his lap. Every time I used to go there, he used to give me 5 shiny new pennies that he saved just for me. He's a wonderful guy. But after that, I became terribly frightened of death. And it's not so much the fact that he died, because I didn't really appreciate that, although I did cry when I found out that I wouldn't see him anymore. But I was terribly frightened at my mother's reaction.
And at the center of it all was the absolute fascination he had with the impact his grandfather's death had on the most important person in his life, his mother. I don't think he knew what this meant, but he knew that it meant something. While the death of David's grandfather was the first, and certainly the most significant at that point, to his still developing mind, it was far from the only visage of the apparition he was to witness in his youth. After all, it was the Bronx, New York City in the late 50s, early 60s, and there was a lot going on, a lot for a young boy to see. Years later, David would list, or rather relive, the deaths he was privy to growing up. The list is as follows, and I'm quoting here. 1. A girl was hit by a car on the Bronx River Parkway and East 172nd Street. She died instantly. I was about 8. 2. A youth from school drowned at the Bronx River near Westchester Avenue. I remember him from school. His face, not his name. I remember the police dragging the river. I left before they found him. Age 9. 3. A girl and her mom were hit by a car and killed on Bruckner Boulevard and Soundview Avenue. Both died instantly. My age, 10. 4. A boy was killed on Watson and Morrison Avenues when he fell from the side of a bus. I saw it, age 13. 5. My girlfriend Elaine Dickens was stabbed by 3 youths outside of PS 77 on Ward Avenue and East 172nd Street. I don't mean my actual girlfriend, I should say classmate. 6. One day I was going to the ball field on Morrison Avenue when a cop car pulled up in front of an alley and the police ran into it. I followed them and in the middle of the yard was an elderly woman lying in a pool of blood. The super yelled to the cops, quote, "She jumped." 7. A man jumped off the roof of a building on Stratford Avenue near Westchester. I remember all the blood. 8. The neighborhood candy store man was stabbed to death in his store on Stratford Avenue near Westchester. The neighborhood talked about it for weeks. I remember the blood splattered all over the glass front of the store. 9. A man drowned in the Eastchester Creek by Co-op City Boulevard. I stood over him while the cops pulled him out. They didn't even chase me. I looked into his open eyes. I'll never forget. End quote. It is clear to see from this that from an early age, David Berkowitz recognized death as an all-important door between two worlds, saying later, quote, I had a tremendous fascination with death. When I thought about dying, I thought about being transported to a world of bliss and happiness, end quote. Act 3. Big City Adoption Blues. Unfortunately for us all, the death of David's grandfather was not the only traumatic event to happen in his life during the late 1950s. There was something else coming, just a short time after, that would have even more import on his developing psyche. David found out he was adopted.
I was astonished when I learned that as young as age 5, his parents had decided to be upfront and honest with him about his origins, you know, tried to describe as clearly as they could that he wasn't their biological offspring.
When I was about 6 or 7, my mother and father sat me down and told me that I was adopted, and they, trying to mean well, right? They said that my mother died while giving birth, and that my father, terribly grief-stricken, had to put me up for adoption.
This was after the scene at your grandmother's death.
Yeah, about a year and a half later.
With the absolute best of intentions, Nat and Pearl pour gas on a grease fire.
Now, in my mind as a child, right, what do you think clicked into my mind? That somehow, that somewhere, my biological father was going through the same thing with regards to my biological mother, who was supposed to have died. But this time, I was responsible because she died while giving birth to me. And I figured somebody like that, you know, is going to be very angry towards me because I lived and she died. I felt cheated. All my life I felt cheated that I was living when I was supposed to be dead, you know?
No longer an observer, David was now at the center of the narrative, a place he had always longed to be. And his young mind took what he was being told and ran with it. He was told that his biological mother had died quite unexpectedly while giving birth to him, and that his birth father, who loved him very much, had been so stricken with grief that he was forced to put him up for adoption. And as a result, David had come, as a child, to be raised by a very thankful Nat and Pearl Berkowitz. But what he heard was that he had killed his birth mother, and attaching the grief he had witnessed Pearl experiencing when her father died to his biological father, became convinced there was a man somewhere on the streets of New York City looking to do him in.
Then after that, I became extremely self-destructive because I thought that I had killed my mother, you see. I was only a child at this time, so I didn't have much understanding. I had perception that I was born and my mother died. Therefore, I caused my mother's death, you understand? Meanwhile, all from childhood, you know, and part of my adult years, I walked around with this death wish because I felt I now had to pay for her death, you see? And that somewhere I thought that there was a man out there that hated me and was possibly going to try to kill me, you see, for causing the death of his wife. You understand what I'm saying?
This, for me, is the first place that David Berkowitz's story goes deeply and significantly off the rails. In a way, it's the first Son of Sam story, as the clumsiness is the first external expression of his inner feelings of guilt. The death-slash-murder fantasy of his biological mother is the first expression of this guilt in a verbal or intellectual sense. The first attempt at turning it into a story. Creating a fantasy by taking what he feels inside and turning it into something tangible. In this fantasy, the planets could be realigned. His real mother could be as good as he was bad, and his real father, the ultimate punisher, coming to pay him back for all his evilness, an idea that mirrored his concept of God. It was something he wanted to believe, something designed to take facts and warp them around something that was already there. It was perfect, the ultimate gift of the ultimate punishment. He could use it to explain everything away. He was evil and he was supposed to be dead. There was a valid reason he felt the way he did. And not only that, but now the wrath of God had an emissary here on earth. Now, there was a tangible opponent. It wasn't just God on some lofty perch somewhere that was looking to take him down. Somewhere out there on the streets of New York, his biological father was looking to find him and kill him. And why shouldn't he? After all, David had murdered his one true love. And so, an already disturbed child, now in an inflamed state of torment, after piecing together the quote-unquote truth behind his adoption, begins, at the tender age of 6, to identify himself as a murderer of women. And this, his biological mother, his first victim. Needless to say, that changed everything.
He had a eureka moment. Oh, I am different. I always felt that I was different from these people. And it just fueled his confusion about the reason that we're here.
I used to cry out to God in my room and stuff. I used to have like the, why don't you kill me, you know? Why don't you, I'm the one who's supposed to die, because I was like an unhappy child, you know? I was just rebellious and, you know, doing all these antisocial things. And I think it all stemmed from this, you see. And so I developed nightmares and things. I was always afraid back then. I developed these like paranoia, somebody was going to kill me in my sleep, you see. And I started to have like nightmares where I couldn't sleep alone and so forth.
David stayed up all night tossing and turning, dodging the quote, shadows and ghosts and all kind of monstrous shapes that terrified me, end quote. And when he did, his dutiful father Nat stayed up with him, sitting on the edge of the bed until David fell asleep, doing whatever he could to soothe this tormented child. But if that didn't work, the pair would give up and David would crawl into bed with Nat and Pearl, unable to bear sleeping alone. As dawn broke the next day, the entire family, exhausted from the night before, set about preparing themselves for what life had in store for each of them. And as David prepared to interact with the kids in the neighborhood, the news of his adoption was never far from his lips.
My friends, I told them I was adopted one day. I said, those aren't my parents. I remember going to school in the second grade. I was going into Miss Witchell's class. She was my teacher. We didn't have to change of periods in public school. You know, we just stayed in one class all day. Remember, I talked to my friends, Jeffrey and Irwin and Al. We used to go to school all the time. And I says, I'm adopted. I remember that day as clearly as if it happened just maybe yesterday. I'm adopted. I said this right in front as we were passing the candy store, where we always used to stop in the afternoon to get a candy bar before we went on to school, a Louis candy store. I said, I'm adopted. And they stopped in their tracks. Get out of here. I said, no, I'm adopted. Those aren't my parents. My mother died when I was born, and they raised me. And they started asking all these questions I didn't know the answers to, you know. And ever since then, they ran home and told their parents, asked their parents if I was adopted.
The news got a big reaction, and not just from the other children.
I remember Jeffrey's mother, Marilyn, asking me, David, why are you telling everyone you're adopted for? And she wanted to know why I was suddenly telling everybody. And my parents told me I was adopted.
The news made him a bit of an outsider. It also made him important.
He sort of wore that around the neighborhood as kind of a badge of dishonor. I don't have to be like you guys. These aren't even my real parents. I'm different, so I don't have to conform to your behavior patterns. It gave him the kind of negative attention and justification that he always sought. Of course, you know, doing a bad thing because I'm not one of you.
I've always had a hard time with my adoption. Accepting it, and I've been stigmatized for it, and insulted. Even when I was a child, when I misbehaved once, a neighborhood woman walked up to me, scolded me in front of all my friends, and she scolded me that I wasn't like my mother, you know, Pearl, or was my adopted mother. I wasn't like her, because she was, as I told you before, a decent person. I was vicious and wild, and she told me, this woman told me that it's because I'm adopted It was a tremendous amount of stigma, you know.
News of the adoption created a bit of a sideshow, and honestly, I can understand why. There were not a lot of adopted kids in the neighborhood. This was Soundview. The neighborhood was filled with large Jewish and Italian families packed into fourth floor walk-ups. Nobody was adopted. There was no need for it. There was plenty of everyone. Soundview was a neighborhood filled with families. Every street was virtually filled with kids. Streets like Seymour Avenue, Fish Avenue, and Burks Avenue. Quote, "I was the only kid in the neighborhood that didn't have a brother or sister," end quote. David didn't know a single solitary soul that was an only child, let alone adopted. All of his friends had many brothers and sisters. Everyone he knew was part of a tribe with many members. And now, not only was he alone, but he didn't even belong to the people who raised him. He couldn't even really count them amongst his number. And in a neighborhood like Soundview, comprised of a litany of small familial armies, that made him feel like an outcast. David had no one, or at least that was how he felt. It was around this time he started to beg Nat and Pearl for a sibling, but of course this wasn't an option. Pearl wasn't able to have children. They had fought so long and hard just to have David, and besides, they couldn't afford it. It just simply wasn't an option. Quote, "I couldn't quite understand why my parents didn't have one for me. I asked them a couple of times, but they never answered. At least they never gave me an answer I could understand. It was that they were too old or didn't have enough money. But it wasn't true because other kids' parents had babies. I guess they didn't want another kid. It was as simple as that." End quote. David was alone, and that was how it was going to stay. David belonged to no one, and no one belonged to him, or at least that was how it felt. The adoption news was isolating, and while it gave him attention, it also put people off.
And that dynamic is going to play out with cousins and others in the family, because that's human nature.
I always had that stigma from the adoption. They always use that as their ultimate, you know. When I was acting a really a bad behavior problem, acting uncontrollably, well, you know, they always stuck that in. I don't know if they thought I understood it. I guess I did understand it, even though I didn't show it. People forget to really forget, maybe they don't realize just how alert and perceptive a child is. More so than even adults, because the child's in the learning stages and intrigued by everything that adults take for granted, you know.
The news of David's adoption began in him a duality that would follow him forever. I am this, but I am also that. Nat and Pearl are my parents, but also there are others. I have other parents. I look innocent, but I am guilty, and soon I will be punished. And so, it was with all this percolating in the background that David Berkowitz began to enter school in 1958, attending PS 77 on Ward Avenue at 172nd Street in the South Bronx. Next time on Killer Tape. Embroiled in an existential torment of his own design, a childhood David Berkowitz uses the anger within him to torment his adoptive mother, Pearl, and Frey, his only substantial connection to the universe.
I used to do things sneaky, in a sneaky way. I used to, like, rip up her clothes or something, you know, tear a hole in her blouse or something. If she had lipstick or something, I remember they came in those little metal canisters, you know, they look like big bullets. I used to run out and turn up the thing so all the lipstick comes out, you know, her favorite lipstick, and then break off the lipstick and then turn it back down, there'd be nothing in there. And when she went to use the lipstick, there'd be nothing there, you know? That's very spiteful, you know? I look at this thing, I'm ashamed of this, you know? I cry sometimes trying to think of what the heck happened, because I don't understand it. She was such a decent person. I could see if she was exceptionally mean or something, but this wasn't the case at all. She was an average type mother, you see. And here I was, one mean guy.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape. the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.